This recording is part of a series of podcasts in which the novel Dear Yoni is read aloud chapter by chapter by the author Lisa Picard. Please note that Dear Yoni contains sexually explicit language and scenes of a sexual nature. It is not suitable for anyone under the age of 18.
Hello, dear listener. I am so pleased that you are continuing to join me week after week as we read further and further into Jess's story. Last week was a very sad part of the book, where we heard about the end of Jess's marriage. And this week, we start on Jess's single life. And I hope you enjoy. Chapter 8, Dreaming of a Different Future. Shortly after my final session with my therapist, I had the weirdest but most wonderful dream. This dream changed everything for me. It provided the impetus I needed to take all of the growth and learning of the past 6 months and to step out onto my new single path. I was finally ready to find some focus in my life again. I awoke the following morning with a huge smile on my face and a sense of immense peace and joy in my heart. Unlike my usual dreams, which I forget the moment I'm fully awake, I remembered this dream in every single detail. In fact, the dream was so incredibly vivid that I drifted around the house in a fugue-like state for the entire morning, until it had finally faded sufficiently for me to actually sit and write it all down. When the dream started, I was drifting through an infinitely vast space. I was definitely myself, but when I looked down to discover how it was that I could be drifting as I was, I realized that I had no feet or legs. In fact, I had no body at all. I was simply a being of pure energy, not contained within any physical form. It felt absolutely wonderful, utterly free and completely blissful. I realized that all of the pain and emotional turmoil of the past several months had simply disappeared from my consciousness. The memories were still intact, but they held no emotional charge whatsoever. In fact, I could see the broader perspective in which it was clear that my life was proceeding absolutely perfectly, and that the difficulties and challenges of the past were also perfect and were leading me to the next phase in my life. Then, as I drifted along, I noticed that there were other beings all around me, and that, by noticing a being, they were immediately brought into my consciousness, no matter how far apart we were geographically. I played around with this novel experience for a while, but then a very bright, warm, an exceptionally beautiful being caught my attention. I felt such an overwhelming sense of attraction to and resonance with this being. As we turned towards each other's presence, a merging began to happen. We began to melt into each other. Our consciousnesses began to merge. It was magical and blissful. A complete opening of the self to the other, and a total, joyful surrender. Eventually, we became one being, and I had complete access to all of the thoughts and memories and emotions and experiences of this being over several lifetimes, and it had access to mine. It was the most incredible feeling of seeing another and being seen in return, utterly and completely. Total vulnerability and perfect intimacy. After an eternity, we slowly began to separate our consciousnesses again, but there was the knowing that we were both completely and irrevocably changed, forevermore, wherever we traveled, in all of eternity, we would always carry the other with us in our consciousness. Such an amazing sense of expansion of awareness, such joy, such bliss, such reverence. For days afterwards, I carried within myself a sense of the sacred, and I knew that I had been shown something deeply profound in my dream. I had been irrevocably altered as a result. I just didn't yet know what it all meant. But the meaning of this wonderful dream was to gradually become clear to me over the next few months on my journey. Day 11. Dear Yoni. That dream marked a turning point for me. Somehow, all of my remaining grief and rage and self-pity had simply dissolved. I also realized that my attempts to save my marriage had not actually been the cause of it ending. James and my sexual experimentation had simply brought into clear focus the problems that had already been there from the very beginning of our relationship. My ex-husband and I just hadn't been sexually very compatible. And I could now admit to myself that our sex life had never been particularly exciting, even in the very beginning. And there were several other incompatibilities that had always made our relationship challenging. We had both been complicit in ignoring these incompatibilities, in looking away from the places that didn't fit the narrative we were so invested in telling ourselves and others about our relationship. I think we both did this because it had been comfortable and convenient, like a pair of warm woolly socks. It had made logical sense for us to stay together, but there had never been any great passion or excitement between us, and no amount of sexual experimentation was ever going to change that. I also realized that I had chosen James as a partner because he had seemed to be the very antithesis of my mother, stable, well-mannered, reasonable, calm, and reliable. My inner child had believed that this would make her safe. She thought that James would never abandon her like my mother had. And of course, the exact opposite had happened. I could now see that this was a crucial point on my path, the realization that nobody else could ever make me feel safe. I needed to create my own sense of safety from within myself. I needed to have my own back. I now believe that although James met Candy through our experimentation, he would have met someone more compatible at some point anyway. Or perhaps I would have. Finally, I reached the place in which I could honestly wish James well in his new life, with his new love and their child. The dream was, for me, a message that there was indeed something more to be found in my sexuality than simply the momentary thrill that I had experienced up to that point. The yearning I had always felt was, in fact, my soul pointing me in the direction that I needed to journey. If I followed that yearning, I knew that I would find my next step. I decided that, even though I was now single, and I couldn't even contemplate at this point dating anyone else, I was going to keep searching until I found what that something more was. Until I found that deep sense of intimacy and connection, that seeing and being seen in return that I knew was possible. And hence, my solo journey towards conscious sexuality began. Although at the time I wasn't aware that that was the journey I was on, I was simply following my curiosity and my inner guidance to the next step without a clear vision of the final destination. I wasn't chasing a tangible outcome, but rather a feeling. I wanted to feel in real life what I had experienced in my dream. But somehow, my entire process was being perfectly guided, as I was to discover over the course of the next few months. Chapter 9. All tied up in knots. I was sitting cross-legged on a yoga mat on the floor of the local community hall, waiting to attend a free introductory workshop on shibari, the ancient Japanese art of rope binding. Friends of mine had recommended with glowing enthusiasm the workshop to me after they had attended it the previous month. Even though I had never experimented with tying anyone up with rope, well, James and I had used silk scarves during our brief foray into bondage. Something within pushed me in the direction of this workshop, and so here I was. My palms were sweaty, and my heart was racing as I glanced around the room. This was my first real step on my solo journey. In fact, It was the first time I had left my house to willingly engage in any way with strangers since my divorce more than 6 months earlier. I felt a bit wobbly and vulnerable, as if I was convalescing from a long illness, and a part of me was wondering what the hell I was actually doing there. Suddenly, all I wanted to do was to get up and run back home to hide away in my bed behind closed curtains for a little while longer. Also, to be honest, I'd always been a tiny bit repulsed by the whole idea of ropes and handcuffs, and I was really wondering what I'd let myself in for. Giving myself a mental shake, I reminded myself that I could always leave if I didn't like it. That thought, unfortunately, reminded me of James. So then I had to give myself an extra hard mental shake and a good talking to prevent myself from dropping into the familiar sadness of the past 6 months. Feeling a bit more confident after my stern internal dialogue, I noticed that the 9 other mats arranged in a semicircle and facing a larger empty mat at the top of the room were now mostly occupied by couples, except for the mat on my left, which was also occupied by a single person. "Hi, I'm Sally," she said, offering her hand as we made eye contact. "Looks like we're the only singles here tonight." "Hi, I'm Jessica," I said, shaking her hand. "I hope that won't be a problem. The ad for this workshop did say that singles or couples were welcome." "Or thruples," she grinned, widening her eyes and inclining her head to indicate a mat at the other side of the circle that was now occupied by 2 rather subdued-looking women, one on either side of a large, heavily tattooed, scowling man. Before I could respond, 2 striking barefoot women wearing tight black lycra workout gear entered the room and made their way to the double mats at the head of the semicircle. The taller of the 2 walked like a dancer, her head held high on a long, slender neck. The smaller woman glided into the room with her hands clasped in front of her and her eyes demurely cast downwards. Upon reaching the mat, she sank gracefully to kneel in complete stillness, her folded hands resting, one over the other on her knees. There was something utterly compelling about her stillness and self-containment. Complete silence descended upon the room. The taller woman, who had remained standing, her feet hip distance apart, posture upright with her shoulders pulled back, took a deep breath and addressed the group. "Good evening, everyone. You may call me Kenzie. I am a Nawashi, or a rope master, or, if you prefer, a Bakushi, or bondage master. I have been practicing the art of Shibari for 25 years. "Hard to believe that. She looks about 20, Sally whispered to me. I kept my eyes on Kenzie. I found myself loath to do anything that would displease our teacher. Despite her slender stature, she emitted a powerful energetic field that had me enthralled. "I am what is called a rigger, which is essentially a shibari top, to borrow a term from the BDSM community." Kenzie gestured to the smaller, demure woman kneeling before her on the mat. "This is Kira. She is what we call in shibari a model, or a bunny. Essentially, she is a bottom, using the parlance of BDSM. Kira and I have been working together for over 5 years, and I will be demonstrating all of tonight's knots and bindings on her." Kira's face remained expressionless, and she didn't move a single muscle as she knelt before Kenzie. Once again, I was totally awestruck at her self-containment. "This 2-hour workshop is called An Introduction to Shibari. It will provide you with the information you need to decide whether this art form is something that would interest you. We will be learning a bit about the history of Shibari, as well as some very basic knots, just to give you a taste of the art form. At the end of the class, Kira and I will give you a demonstration of some of the more complicated knots on the floor. We will not be doing any suspension work tonight. So let's start off with a little history lesson." "I've seen some videos of the suspension stuff," Sally whispered to me. "It's frickin' scary." I suppressed a flicker of irritation as I ignored her interruption and tried to pay attention to Kenzie. "The word shibari means to tie or to bind. Shibari is the ancient Japanese art of rope bondage, in which intricate, beautiful knots and patterns are constructed to restrain the model and to provide sensation. Shibari originated in the practice of Hojujutsu, which was used by the samurai to bind prisoners who were tied according to their crime. So the patterns of knots served a symbolic and an aesthetic purpose, as well as a means to identify the crime committed. It was also sometimes used as a form of torture, as certain knots can be extremely uncomfortable, to say the least. Kenzie smiled gently as she said this, and a shiver ran up my spine. There was something rather disconcerting about this woman. She was so petite and slender, yet she came across as someone definitely not to be trifled with. Shibari later made its way into the underground Japanese BDSM scene. Nowadays, in the Western world, Shibari is practiced as an art form, a form of expression, or indeed as a form of foreplay, where the tying is about bondage or restraining the bottom. However, Shibari is not always about sex, but definitely always about intimacy and closeness with the other person, because of how much trust goes into the process. For many people, Shibari focuses on aesthetics, with each tie having symbolism, and the rope tying is the main course. It's not just about foreplay before sex. As I've already mentioned, the person tying the ropes is called the rigger, and the person being tied up is called the bunny. Mostly practitioners of Shibari are fixed in the roles that they assume. However, in some cases, we find people who are rope switchers, meaning that they can be both tops and bottoms. There are also people who practice self-tying without any partner at all. Unbidden, an image of me tying myself up in ropes in my locked bedroom sprang to mind. A little snort of laughter escaped from my lips, and Kenzie turned to look at me with a tiny crease between her brows. Chastened, I hunched up my shoulders and frowned to indicate that I was listening intently. Although I felt a little embarrassed, I realized that I was actually enjoying being out of the house and learning something completely new, and so I focused once more on Kenzie's words. So let's talk a little about the rope we use in Shibari. Only natural fiber ropes with very little stretch are used. A 3-strand, 6mm rope of 7 to 8 meters in length is good for most purposes, although, as you progress with the art form, more subtleties in rope selection will come into play. Another essential is a cutting tool to ensure that you will be able to rapidly cut your bunny out of the ropes if needed. A little shiver of apprehension ran up my spine as I contemplated under what conditions such a tool might be necessary. As if reading my mind, Kenzie said, "We try to prepare as fully as we can before performing a scene, but sometimes things don't go completely according to plan and we need to rapidly end a scene. This is where you will use the cutting tool to remove the ropes." Shibari is meant to be a meditation, which brings about deep relaxation and trust building. It is never meant to be about pain, force, or degradation, although discomfort can sometimes be experienced. The idea is for the bunny to relinquish control and to relax into the discomfort, much in the way you would relax into a yoga pose, thus bringing about a very vulnerable but deeply empowering state of complete surrender and relaxation. The goal is to be totally mindful and present in the body. Hence the idea that Shibari is a form of meditation. However, it can be psychologically and physically intense, which is why a scene is always preceded by a detailed communication about boundaries and consent, which goes both ways, for the rigger and for the model. It's also important to always be aware of the potential risks involved and to be prepared for them. Furthermore, a safe word is always selected before the scene, and if either the rigger or the bunny uses the safe word, the scene ends immediately. Such a safe word would not be something like no or stop, as sometimes the bunny would use such words to role play during a scene. It should be a word that would not normally be used in such a context. For example, umbrella or giraffe. In Shibari, we distinguish between lab time, which is where you learn and perfect your ties, and scene time, which is where you actually perform your art. A Shibari scene can be floor play or suspension play, which is only for advanced practitioners. Now, before we move on to the actual knots and ties, are there any questions? Kenzie scanned the room, but there was absolute silence. It seemed as if no one wished to risk asking a question that might be considered to be stupid. Or perhaps we were all just caught in her spell. As there were no questions, Kenzie continued. In Shibari, we view the legs, arms, wrists, ankles, etc. as columns. So a single column tie would be a knot on one body part, whereas a double column tie will tie two body parts together. One of the most common single column ties is the Somerville bowline knot. This is a strong knot. It is resilient and won't collapse under tension. It is easy to make and can also be knotted with a quick release option. Kenzie placed her hand on Kira's shoulder, and the petite woman gracefully rose to her feet. She had still not lifted her eyes from the ground. Wordlessly, Kira offered her hands a few centimeters apart, palms down to Kenzie. Kenzie picked up a length of rope and folded it in half. In traditional Shibari, the rope is folded in half, creating a loop or bite on one end and a tail or working end on the other. Now, this is how we do the Somerville bowline on a single column, in this case, the wrist. I watched intently as Kenzie demonstrated the knot a few times over and then said, "Now it's your turn to give it a try with your partners." Kenzie nodded her head to Kira, who glided away to fetch a basket of rope lengths, which she proceeded to hand out to the course participants. "I guess we'll be partners then," Sally said brightly. "Do you want to tie me up first?" I took the length of rope, folded it in half, and wrapped it around Sally's wrists in the way that Kenzie had showed us. It was really quite easy to make the knot, and I felt a warm glow of satisfaction in my stomach as Kenzie nodded in approval at my attempt. After a few more tries, which became increasingly simpler and quicker to complete, Sally gave it a go. Then Kenzie demonstrated how to do a quick-release version of the same knot. By the time that we all sat down again to learn about a few other ties, I realized that I was actually really enjoying myself. There was something deeply satisfying about producing a perfect knot. Or perhaps it was just that I was out of the house and learning something new. Either way, I felt good about it. Over the course of the next 20 minutes, we learned how to do a few additional knots, including the half hitch and the full hitch. Then Kira collected the ropes and returned the basket to the corner. "That's all the knots that you're going to learn how to do tonight. But Kira and I will demonstrate a few basic ties, which you will be taught if you decide to enroll in our training course. After this demonstration, to end the short workshop, we'll enact a brief floor play scene. So firstly, this is a basic chest harness." I watched as Kenzie wrapped and knotted the rope over and under Kira's breasts to produce a rather attractive binding that emphasized Kira's small, shapely breasts. This harness can be used as the basis for suspension work. Another chest harness, which is used to accentuate the masculine physique, is called the bulldog harness. Kenzie proceeded to demonstrate a full body harness, followed by a chest to leg tie, and then a pentagram or star harness, and finally the hishikarada or the rope dress. She even demonstrated a hair bondage tie on Kira's long silky black hair. My mind boggled at what the use of that tie could possibly be, but I didn't dare to ask. "Are there any questions?" Kenzie asked, as she untied Kira's hair from the tight binding. "Exactly how much rope is needed for these ties?" asked a rather large woman sitting to my right. "I mean, Kira's tiny. I'm pretty sure I'll need way more rope than that." Kenzie smiled. "The beauty of Shibari is that it is completely customizable. The rope ties can be crafted to fit any body size or shape, and even the range of mobility possible for each individual model. But there are definitely some guidelines as to the amount of rope needed for different sized bodies. For example, for the full body harness I demonstrated, one measures the amount of rope needed from the shoulder, down between the legs, and back up to the shoulder again, multiplied by 6. And for chest and hip harnesses, we use 6 times the hip measurement. "Not sure they make ropes long enough for me to have a hip harness," the large lady quipped to her partner. "Right, let's briefly talk about untying your partner. Untying is just as much fun and as much of an art form as tying them up," Kenzie informed us. While she was speaking, she was rapidly redoing the chest harness she had demonstrated earlier on Kira. The important thing to remember is to keep body contact with your bunny, to make them feel as safe as possible. This can mean using single hand untying, or leaning your bunny against your chest as you use both hands to untie a knot. Also, keep your hand on the knot you're untying, so as not to allow the end to whip your bunny in the face as it pulls through. That's a surefire passion killer. I watched in fascination as Kenzie untied Kira. It was disciplined, precise, and controlled, but somehow also deeply caring, almost loving. I was amazed. So many of my preconceptions had already been challenged during this workshop. Now Kira and I will demonstrate a 10-minute floor play, which will give you an idea of how a scene could progress. Shibari is not only about proficiency in the ties and knots. It's also about the speed, the intensity, and the rhythm with which you tie and untie the ropes. It can be gentle, soft, sensuous, and slow, or fast, hard, and aggressive, depending upon what you want to convey in the scene. In a scene like this, rope is the language for communication with your partner's body. When we're done, please don't applaud or make any other sound, but just get up and leave the room quietly. Kira and I will be in a very intimate and vulnerable space and should not be disturbed. Thank you for attending this introductory workshop. If you'd like to explore Shibari further, please grab a brochure of my offerings from the table outside the hall when you leave. Well, what followed next was a spectacle that I will never, ever forget. It was, without a doubt, the most erotic act I have ever witnessed. Even though both women remained fully clothed throughout, I was touched on some very deep level by the demonstration, but it would be some time before I would be able to comprehend just why that was. One thing was certain, as I watched Kenzie perform one tie after the next on Kira, I now, finally, truly understood how Shibari could be called an art form. It was as if the two women had created between them a force field which absorbed all the sound and energy in the room. And every eye was riveted on the spectacle in front of us. The only sounds were the hiss and the snap of the rope and the gentle rhythmic breathing of Kenzie. Every now and then Kira's breath would hitch as Kenzie pulled the rope tight or manipulated Kira's body into a new position. Kenzie varied the speed and the intensity as she worked. It was truly like watching a dancer perform. Her body remained in close contact with Kira's body at all times as she bound her model's body into intricate shapes, many of which had to be at least a little bit uncomfortable, despite the obvious flexibility of Kira's body. Kira had clearly surrendered completely to Kenzie, who moved Kira's body on the floor using various ties as well as her own body weight. It was highly ritualized and deeply erotic. I was absolutely spellbound. I also realized that I was becoming extremely turned on by the spectacle in front of me. I felt like a voyeur watching something so intimate and vulnerable that it was at times close to painful to observe. I almost wanted to turn away to give the two women their privacy, but a part of me couldn't bear to miss a single second of their compelling performance. Kira was so completely surrendered to Kenzie, who conveyed such a sense of power, competence, and trustworthiness. Both women were totally present in the moment and totally focused. I had never witnessed anything like it, nor have I since. Finally, all the ropes were removed from Kira's body, and the two women sat, legs outstretched, Kenzie with her front pressed against Kira's back and her arms holding her partner with exquisite tenderness, while Kira turned her head to nestle under Kenzie's chin. Both had their eyes closed and were breathing rhythmically in unison. There was a protracted moment of utter silence. It felt as if everyone in the room had just participated in something sacred, and that we were all somehow bound together, with no ropes necessary, in this infinite moment of reverence. Finally, Some of the participants began to collect their belongings and to silently file out of the room. I felt as if I was under a spell as I left, and there was no talking whatsoever as we all exited the hall. Even garrulous Sally appeared to have been silenced by the profound nature of what we had just observed, and she didn't even say goodbye as we all took our leave. The effects of the experience remained with me for several days. I attempted to explain it to a friend, but I found it utterly impossible to recreate for her in words the emotional impact of the demonstration. I began to do further research about Shibari, specifically the suspension work which had piqued my curiosity, and I found myself tumbling down a very strange rabbit hole indeed. I watched several YouTube videos of riggers performing suspension work on their models, who were almost exclusively young, slender, and beautiful women. Many of the videos had the same dreamlike quality that I had observed in Kenzie and Kira's demonstration, and I was aware of a potent mix of fascination and repulsion as I observed women being bound and trussed up into bizarre and what had to be painful positions, either suspended or tied to poles. Now I knew how the hair shibari that Kenzie had demonstrated came into play, and I almost wished that I didn't. In several of the videos, the women's heads were held at various angles by tying their hair to beams above them, while the rest of their limbs were arranged in a variety of strange positions by suspending them from beams or poles. After an afternoon spent watching this art form, I firmly decided that my repulsion vastly outweighed my fascination, and I gratefully relinquished my research. I felt as if I had returned from some strange and alien world as I sat down to enjoy a normal cup of coffee in my normal kitchen on an ordinary Saturday afternoon. But even though I had decided that Shibari was not for me, there was an insight that Kenzie's demonstration had provided that would finally come to fruition for me some months in the future. Day 12. Dear Yoni, my brief foray into Shibari kept popping into my mind over the next few weeks. Although I was absolutely sure that Shibari wasn't for me, there was definitely something there that kept tickling an inaccessible corner of my mind, something that attracted me, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. Certainly, I had been wondering about the intense pleasure some people seemed to be able to derive from experiencing discomfort and pain, and I had watched several interviews with the Shibari models, and they had all seemed to find the experience deeply satisfying on some level that I simply couldn't comprehend. The answer remained tantalizingly out of reach until a month or so later when I encountered a quote on my Facebook thread that seemed to offer some insight. Apparently Buddha taught that pain is just intense sensation. It only becomes suffering when you add fear. The thought occurred to me that perhaps the models were so completely surrendered to the rigor and to the process that they weren't resisting the discomfort and pain. Therefore, they weren't suffering. The pain allowed them to become completely present, completely mindful, and in this state is where they found some form of bliss. I did a bit more research, and I found out that Buddhism teaches that as fearful thoughts arise in the mind, one should simply witness them and let them go. When they arise again, you witness and let them go again. Over and over again, this is repeated until eventually the fearful thoughts stop producing adrenaline and they simply become boring. Now, without fear, the pain is merely sensation and there is no further suffering. Who would ever have thought that there could be any connection whatsoever between kink and Buddhism? But with this new understanding, I felt ready to further explore the wacky world of kink. Although I was sure that Shibari was not for me, I thought that it might be worthwhile exploring whether there could be other practices that might add further dimensions to my quest for that all-elusive something more in sex that was leading me forward on this journey. The most obvious kink, well, to me anyway, was BDSM, and so I decided that this was to be my next solo adventure. And that's it for today, dear listener. Join me again next week. Bye-bye.